I'm Kara Swisher, and you're listening to Sway. My guest today is Jaron Lanier. He's been in Silicon Valley even longer than I have, and I am really old. He first showed up in the 1980s and was one of the earliest pioneers of virtual reality. But over the years, he's become a prominent critic in the tech world of social media companies in particular, or, quote, behavior modification empires, as he likes to call them. Jaron works for Microsoft these days, which has gone all in on the global race to build the metaverse. And it's not alone. Facebook, Snap, Epic, Roblox, and more are all trying to stake a claim. But with these companies pouring billions of dollars into the race for the metaverse, it's still not clear what it would actually look like or if people will use it at all. So I wanted to talk to Jaron about that and why Mark Zuckerberg's vision of it may not prevail. Jaron, welcome to Sway. There is so much for us to talk about.
There is so much, and it's so good to be here to talk to you.
So I guess I wanted to start by talking about social media. Obviously, the last time you and I talked was after the release of your 2018 book, if you can believe it, 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. You don't have any social media accounts yourself. So I'd love to sort of get your reflection about that book, because it was quite early and prescient about a lot of things.
It's funny, because to me, it doesn't feel so early. And in a way, not much has changed since that book was written, because the world is held in a vice grip by the algorithms of a few companies that operate on this bizarre business model in which they make money from people who hope to manipulate other people using behavior modification techniques. And it's such a weird and strange and dark turn in human history. Foreseen in some dark science fiction, certainly, but to see it actually happen, of course, has been the tragedy of my career and my whole generation of computer scientists. And even our discussions to try to get out from under it tend to get ruined by it.
Because why? Why is that?
I think the pattern is that people tend to take on some of the worst qualities that are associated with the constant excitation of what we can call the lizard brain. They become a little more irritable, vain, contemptuous, clannish, dismissive, disrespectful, fearful, above all else, and coward in a way. And when those things happen, as we speak about social media, there's a kind of a feeling of, if I can call it, a meta hopelessness.
We'll get to the metaverse. We're going to get to the metaverse, Jaron. Don't worry. But I want to stick with for a second with social media. So you've never been on social media. Is that correct?
No, going back before the term social media existed, or even before the web existed, as early as the 70s, there were some prototype designs like Usenet that some folks might remember. Mm-hmm. It was somewhat similar to what we'd call a comment role these days. The earliest versions were quite raw. They were divided by topic, but there wasn't anything like upvoting or downvoting. And we had the experience of amplifying the lizard brain even on those, where people would get pissier than they otherwise would. And so I decided very early on that I'm not perfect, and I worry about using something that brings out the worst in me. I've made a few other decisions in my life, like, for instance, I don't drink alcohol for a similar reason, and it's an unusual decision. Most people do drink alcohol. My intuition is it wouldn't be good for me. It wouldn't bring out the best in me, and it wouldn't instead bring out the worst. So I just don't do it. And I feel that way even more strongly about algorithmically driven
social media
designs online. But it never occurred to me that we would be so perverse that the primary business model of some of the biggest companies of the world would be to make that thing worse. That's just astonishing.
So how is it? Why is it different? Why did that bring out the lizard brain? There's lots of technologies that people use. Why is this particular, and I'll use the term social media, but you could call it a lot of different things, whether it was Usenet or Facebook or whatever. Why was that from your perspective?
Well, the degree of problem on something like Usenet was noticeable, but it wasn't, civilization threatening. What made it worse is the thing that I particularly object to. And that thing is using a feedback loop of what somebody has done in the past to influence what they see in the present in order to change how they'll behave in the future. This is called behavior modification. It was studied by scientists called behaviorists. The two most famous ones are probably Pavlov and B.F. Skinner. And so what you do is you put the, in the case of B.F. Skinner, perhaps a pigeon or a rat in a feedback loop where you're training them to do something. And when they do what you want them to do, they get a reward. When they do something that you don't want them to do, they might get an electric shock or punishment. And in the social media world, we don't at present have electric shocks or candy dispensers. We might.
Well, you get the likes and the not likes.
Right, you get social pain and social pleasure. Rejection, humiliation, isolation, etc. are the electric shocks. And then the occasional, you know, likes and rewards or hope that you'll go viral or whatever. That stuff is the candy.
Should people still give up on all social media? Is there, you know, or are we just fucked up pigeons in a box, essentially? I mean, there's good things, organizing protests around the murder of George Floyd. Some of the organizational things are important.
I think it would be preposterous to deny that there are good things. My favorite thing is people with rare diseases finding each other and being able to compare notes. That wasn't possible before. But it has to be said that all of those good things could happen without this algorithmic overlord. You could have all of the good of the internet and all of the good we associate with social media, which is real, without this crazy making business model. And that's why I find a fallacy in a lot of thinking. That's like, well, we just have to deal with Facebook making the world darker and crazier because we need this or that. That's not true at all.
Mm-hmm. So talk about one of your arguments that users should actually pay for things like search and social networking. Explain that. Why isn't it inevitable?
This is the alternate economic model for the internet that I and many others have been interested in. It's called data dignity. Instead of starting with paying for stuff, which people do, I mean, people pay for the New York Times, for one example, you might be aware of.
I've heard.
But also a lot of gaming is paid for. A lot of things get paid for and people are okay with it. It's just that we've set expectations that certain things like search and YouTube-style video sharing should be free. And of course, social media as we know it. Now, the thing is, the reason these things are free is that they're a barter in exchange for the data from people. The data is highly valuable. The data has been the raw materials driving the largest companies. And there's no particular reason why that data shouldn't be paid for. So, I mean, the question is, why aren't people paid? And interestingly, Facebook has repeatedly made statements about how useless it would be, as if this was a major argument being made. So they anticipate that it's maybe not a major argument, but that it'll be a good and powerful one, and in fact, a correct one. So they're already positioning themselves to try to fight it purely based on its correctness.
I asked Steve Case about this. He was at an investor meeting. He said, we make $10 from every person through the data, et cetera. I put up my hand. I said, where's my $5? You know what I mean? And everybody laughed, but I was like, why are we being such cheap dates to your free stuff? Because you get all the benefit and we get all the, you know.
Yeah. I want to make a metaphor. I'm very interested in somebody named Edward Deming. So he was operating about a century ago. He became interested in the idea that factories could improve the quality of their production if they gathered data from the field, if they had statistical data. And this became what's known as the quality movement. And one of the interesting things about Deming is he wanted the feedback data from the field not just to go to owners and elite engineers, but to factory workers, with the theory that they're the ones with eyes on what's actually going on the factory floor, and they'll be able to notice how to take that data and turn it into better product. Now, by analogy, what's going on today with a company like Google or Meta is that they're getting all this data for free from people who don't understand the meaning or the value of the data, and then turning it into these algorithms that are mostly used to manipulate the same people. And it's a little like the situation before Deming showed up in factories. Like, why on earth are the people producing the data not in on the game and not able to try to make it better?
Right.
And might not this be the right way to solve these seemingly hopeless problems like bias and AI algorithms and whatnot by just having a lot more eyeballs on them of people who care? So that makes sense to me. And so the way this would work is that people would license their data.
They license their data. Okay, all right. All right. Okay.
But they wouldn't license it as individuals. They'd have to join into organizations. And the reason why is to avoid a descent into each against each battle, which is not an economy. They would band together. And then these entities would be the first advocates that anybody would have online at all. I mean, there's a crazy thing, which is going back to medieval times, there's been a thing called the fiducial, which is if somebody has expertise and information that's deeply relevant to you and you pay that person, they have to swear to put your interests first. And that's, doctors are like that, lawyers are like
that. Fiduciary duty, that's where it comes from.
Fiduciary duty, exactly. And the internet is beyond anybody. Nobody understands the click-through agreements. Nobody understands what's happening with their data. And yet these things are important to us. For the first time, there'll be a body positioned to be an advocate for groups of power that's also got a means of funding.
So how does that happen then? How should people interact with tech and social media now? Because it's ubiquitous, hard to avoid, and obviously during the pandemic has become even more difficult to avoid, or you don't want to avoid it because that's how you have to operate. I myself, for example, I'm not getting off Twitter. I enjoy it. It's an entertainment for me in a lot of ways.
And the funny thing is, like, I would never get on Twitter, and yet I like Jack Dorsey, and I feel like he actually is trying to figure out some way through this maze to make it better, you know? So it's not a matter of villainizing other people. It's a matter of making personal choices based on your priorities. And one of the things I said in the 10 Arguments book is I'm not telling anybody what to do. I don't say you must delete your accounts. If you really are sure that your life would be damaged if you deleted your accounts, it doesn't do anyone else any good for you to damage your life. But I do have to say, there's something fishy going on here because I sell books. I get asked on media. I have a life that's similar probably to what somebody would have if they were a successful influencer or whatever. And yet I have no social media accounts. I could very well be an exception. On the other hand, I have to say, I can't be that much of an exception. I'm not a young person in a bikini. I'm not a person. You didn't have to agree quite that much, but yes, okay, fine. And I'm not trying to be trendy. I'm not, and yet somehow it's working. And I sometimes think that a lot of people have bought into an illusion and they're racing on this hamster wheel for somebody else's benefit, where in fact, if they got off the wheel, their career would be similar. So I'm not sure how true that is or how often it's true, because it's very hard to test an idea like that. But I do suspect a lot of us are trapped in this hamster wheel cycle, and we would do just as well without it. That's a guess.
But let me just ask you, you started off excited about the possibilities. You and I have talked for many, a long, long, long time about the possibilities. But in 2011, you said, I am disappointed in the way the internet has gone in the past 10 years. So talk about the possibilities you had hoped at the beginning, because where we are is lizard brain, but what were your hopes at the time?
Yeah, well, I mean, my peak optimism was probably in the 80s when I was introducing the concept of virtual reality to the world. And what I saw in virtual reality was potentially something that would be wonderfully good for the world, and I still think it could be and maybe will be. I saw a way to finally appreciate how wondrous our given reality is by having a point of comparison. We take what we have for granted so easily, but if you've spent some time in virtual reality and then you go into a real forest, I think you're able to love that forest in a more visceral way than is readily apparent otherwise. And many, many similar examples, just looking at someone else's face is astonishing after you've been in virtual reality for a while.
Mm-hmm. So that was your hope, that it would give people an appreciation of both the analog and the digital.
And I also had this hope, even back then, there was this question of what will happen if automation gets very good. And the old idea of the job doesn't really apply so much anymore. And I had this idea that gradually the economy and civilization in general would shift more away from necessity to creativity, where more and more people would be like artists, or basically artists in one sense or another, very, very broadly speaking, as more and more kinds of robots, more and more kinds of software became available and became usable, that people would create an economy based on growing intelligence, growing depth of communication, and just growing beauty. And why not? what would be wrong with that? And I should also say, even back then, it seemed like the only way to think of a long-term future for people was either a creative economy or some kind of static economy in a bubble, or a temporary one where we destroy ourselves and we consume ourselves to death. Because even at that time, we already understood that there would be limits. We didn't have the details of climate change.
Physical limits to what we were doing to the planet.
Right. It's just obvious to any scientist or engineer. And yet there's no reason there should be cultural limits. There's no reason why humanity can't grow and deepen forever. And so I thought of virtual reality as a little technological token of that hope of eternal creativity.
Yeah. All right. So I want to get to the idea of the metaverse. Talk about what it is to you, and then let's talk about what Facebook just described in its presentation recently.
Well, I probably made the first implementations of it by most measures. For instance, I did the first multi-person headset virtual reality stuff, which is in fact what the term virtual reality meant originally. And, you know, listening to Mark Zuckerberg talk, it sounds like some megalomaniac took my stuff and filtered it through some weird self-aggrandizement filter. I mean, it's just the weirdest thing. And my thought of it always was that, like, it would emerge, it would be like 100 million micro-entrepreneurs doing their little thing here and there, and there wouldn't be some overlord.
Yeah, so we just talked about that idea. You thought it would be a lot of different companies. Your vision of it was not unsimilar. It was that we had these virtual worlds that we then moved into real worlds, or they would be mixed, but it would be created by lots of different people, and people would move through them. That is how you thought of the idea of what a metaverse is. So essentially, you feel like Mark's put it in a blender, his blender, mashed it up in some weird way. Is his metaverse a hamster wheel on steroids, essentially, from what you could see?
Well, you know, one thing about it is the communications from Facebook and now Meta are not entirely coherent if you really know about the stuff. For instance, they show a lot of scenarios where there wouldn't actually be any place to put the sensors to enable the scenario or the displays to enable it. Like, it's a kind of a weird disembodied vision of virtual reality, whereas any implementation of virtual reality has to have sensors and displays that create it, you know. But they have forms of presentation that are sort of as if they were in a science fiction movie and didn't require implementability.
That's a nice way of saying it don't work.
Well, I mean, some version of it could work, but it's just strange that they don't feel a need to resolve basic issues of geometry and physics and engineering that really are not going to be avoidable. Now, you could say, well, who cares? That's all details. But the thing is, those details are where the experience will be.
So one of the things what Mark Zuckerberg had introduced, a lot of people feel like it's a land grab, that Facebook's trying to establish itself as a leader in the metaverse, even though other companies, including yourself, had worked on, you know, Roblox, working at Snap, Epic, Amazon. Who has the competitive advantage here?
I mean, I'm going to venture a guess that if Tim Cook hadn't started to shut down Facebook's access to free data, that Meta would never have happened. I think what Meta is kind of about is we don't own the peripheral device that gets the data in the current round. So in the future, we need to win the next device war so that we'll be able to get the data. And, you know, oh, it would be nice if we owned smart speakers and doorknobs and whatever, but Amazon got those. So let's go for headsets. I think that's what it's ultimately about. It's about the fact that you have to own the edge device to have your own power of making your cloud good or evil. And he wants to make it evil, apparently. And so he needs to own a device and he currently doesn't.
That's funny.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, I shouldn't, this is intemperate of me in a way, and I shouldn't speak this way about another company, but there's no other Silicon Valley company that's had this parade of executives leaving with deep regrets. And it's like, it's extraordinary. I mean,
don't worry, Walt Mossberg said worse.
Okay, can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
I believe Facebook is undervalued for what it does, because Facebook is essentially running identity for the internet, which is a very valuable function. So under a data dignity regime, I think Facebook would double or triple in value very quickly. So I'm not anti-Facebook per se. And I also like the idea of people who've invested in tech getting rewarded for it. I think it has a terrible business model. And I think that's it's successful enough that the stakeholders of Facebook think they're doing well. I think they're not doing nearly as well as they should, and they're missing out on the benefit they should have.
Yeah, many people think that.
Just to be clear, I like the idea of Facebook doing well. I just want it to do well on a business plan that isn't based on harming the humanity. You know, I mean, I think that that's reasonable.
Okay. The company you work for, Microsoft, announced that it's building a metaverse too. Let's play a clip from their announcement video. This is the CEO, Satya Nadella, talking.
It's no longer just looking at a camera view of a factory floor. You can be on the floor. It's no longer just video conferencing with colleagues. You can be with them in the same room.
So can you talk about the different versions of this metaverse from Facebook's, what Satya Nadella there was talking about?
I feel like I should just bring up, when I'm speaking to you as an individual, absolutely unfettered and speaking my mind, but I also sometimes...
You work for Microsoft.
Yeah. You know, I think the core of Microsoft's business is selling products and services. And the core of that is to enterprises, which means, you know, businesses. And the great thing about that is it keeps you honest. If somebody else is putting up their money, you better be giving them something that's worth that money. It's not tricky, you know, it's not like, oh, we'll give you this for free, but then we're going to trick you with this other thing. It's like very concrete. So can we improve a factory by augmenting it? Yeah. You know, like the area that I've done the most work in of this kind is probably surgical simulation. And then second to that is vehicle simulation, both of which have really been successful. Like, I mean, a long time ago, working with Joe Rosen and Ann Lasko at Stanford Med, I worked on the very first surgical simulator with a headset, and that's blossomed. A few years ago, when my wife had cancer, her surgeon trained in a procedure that had been designed in virtual reality and was trained by a guy who was a student of Joe Rosen, my partner from the old days. And so the whole thing came around, you know, and her surgery went beautifully. So that was totally successful and went mainstream. Similarly, it's been some years since you can even get in a new car or plane or boat or any vehicle really that wasn't designed in virtual reality to a degree. That's also become mainstream. So those are cases that worked out extremely well. But yeah, you know, I think if you have a specific use case where there would be real money at stake and a real customer, either you can improve it enough to justify that money or you can't.
So more clear cut of what the transaction actually is versus you didn't know you were selling your kidney, but now it's gone, your virtual kidney. So when you're thinking about this, what it's going to look like, can you explain how it would be different than using the internet now, what it will look like with these avatars, projections of ourselves, et cetera? Give us a few details of how you imagine it's going now.
The funny thing is, I don't want to make it sound good if it's going to be applied in a horrible way to destroy humanity. Like I spent many years.
You don't want to give them the map to the Death Star if it's going to be used to blow up planets, right?
Yeah, I spent many years conjuring visions of just how wonderful it might be. But I really do keep on coming back to, however fantastical it might be, the best moment is the moment you take off the headset and you can see the world with fresh senses. That never gets old. That never goes away.
But will it look like what these depictions of both Microsoft and Facebook, which were not unsimilar, are going to be like?
Well, those have kind of been, you know, what sort of happened is there was this cycle where, so when we were building the first commercial multi-person virtual worlds, the first commercial headsets and all that, I had friends who at the same time, like Neil Stephenson and Bill Gibson, who were publishing the early cyberpunk novels, right? And the cyberpunk novels, in turn, had a huge impact on cinema. And you ended up kind of with this cinematic vision of the future that became incredibly commonplace, with the Matrix movies or Inception being some examples that are well-known these days. But there was this weird cycle where technologists influenced novelists, who influenced movies, who influenced corporate communications. And so this whole thing kind of cycled around, and a certain kind of visual language emerged that you see in all the companies' communications about this
and
now.
So that's why the virtual reality looks the way it does.
Yeah, and personally, I think it'll look a lot better than that, but whatever.
We'll be back in a minute. If you like this interview and want to hear others, follow us on your favorite podcast app. You'll be able to catch up on Sway episodes you may have missed, like my conversation with Snap CEO Evan Spiegel, and you'll get new ones delivered directly to you. More with Jaron Lanier after the break. So let me move on to something else. The entrepreneur Sean Puri had a Twitter thread on the metaverse where he made the case the metaverse doesn't necessarily have to be a virtual place. It's actually a time. He said, quote, our attention used to be 99% in our physical environment. TVs dropped that to 85%, computers down to 70%, phones 50%. Soon some company will make smart glasses that sit in front of our eyes all day. We'll go from 50% attention on the screens to about 90% or more. That is the moment in time when the metaverse starts, because at that moment, our virtual life will become more important than our real life. What do you think about that?
Right. Well, I find it astonishing because when you try to understand reality as it is, and you start to appreciate just how subtle it is, or if you just, I don't know, just playing a real bamboo flute compared to any digital instrument ever, or just like a real person, just being with a real person, like looking at their face, touching them, I think there's an infinity, an open horizon for all time of just appreciating the physical world more, whereas the digital world can also grow and become more and more creative. I've noticed lately that anything you can use to write text with that's digital is starting to try to predict ahead. So we're letting the past of language control the future of language in a way that it didn't before. But at the same time, ultimately, the digital world is us stewing in our own juices, that the algorithms are based on taking the past and limiting the future to the past.
Yeah, I always go, no, I'll do my suggestion. I'm always resisting it. Resistance is futile.
Yeah, no, me too. I hate that stuff. But the thing is, if you want to try to draw an airtight sense of the world where there's no mystery and everything makes perfect sense, you'll find that you can't. There's always some seam. There's some seam, like some observer problem or some, like, why are we here and not there? What is it that positions us here? And you always end up back with a kind of a mystical sense of experience. You can't really get rid of something about the experience itself that's a little metaphysical. And so the thing is that any digital world, no matter how elaborate, no matter how beautiful, is going to be most valuable as a form of contrast to notice that mystery.
You can see the seams is what you're talking about.
That's where you find the future. That's where you find sort of an open-ended infinity.
There's an excellent quote by Tom Stoppard in Arcadia, when we have found all the mysteries and lost all the meaning, we will be alone on an empty shore, which I always loved.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Remember that? So one of the things, what do you think that existing in the virtual world does to your sense of self, for example? And for reference, you wrote about VR. Who is it who is suspended in nothing experiencing these events? It is you, but not exactly. What is left of you when you can change virtually everything about your body and the world? Can you talk about what that does to a sense of self, even if you emerge from it?
Well, I mean, humans are perverse. And
yes.
Every time I think of something that will be, oh, this is an absolute good, people will find in this a lovely spiritual positivity. And then somebody else will look at the same thing and say, oh, no, this is going to be how we manipulate each other. So like, I don't want to sound overly naive. But what I found to be interesting about turning into an avatar is that the avatar can be much more radical than is generally thought. Like the avatars in corporate communications kind of look like you. They're sort of realistic, but you can turn into fantastical other creatures. It turns out your brain is pre-adapted to control extra limbs, so you can take on all these different body plans. Really fantastic things. In fact, we learned a lot about neurology and evolution just from looking at what avatars are possible. The thing is, if you change your avatar, you change the world, you can screw around with a sense of the passage of time. And when you can change all these things, and yet there's something that's still there, to my knowledge, that's the only technology that's ever come along that makes you notice that your consciousness is a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that, I just interviewed Jeanette Winterson, and this is something she writes about. Basically, she thinks that someday we might leave our physical bodies behind altogether and our consciousness could exist in the digital space. Do you agree with that?
I mean, this has been one of the bigger topics I've had to deal with in my life because people keep on bringing it up. The shortest answer is no, I don't. Because for one thing, it suggests that there's something lacking in the given world. And, I didn't come at it from thinking about virtual reality before trying it. I tried it before thinking about it. And for me, it just was plainly obvious that what virtual reality was good for was noticing how magical conventional reality is. I think that's what's special. And this notion of wanting to leave the body behind and entering a digital realm has a way of morphing into Catholic ideas, but really old ones, because you end up with this idea that you'll enter into this heaven, but in order to enter it, you need to have right thinking, because if you think the wrong thing, some super intelligent AI from the future will figure out a way to strike you down, because you might, you know, like this whole weird theology that comes about.
Well, although it is kind of interesting that the richest people in the world either want to get off the planet or go into a virtual setting. So one of the things you said is metaphor is going to destroy humanity. Talk about the dark side of this. What do you must think about? You must think about this because it happened in Newsnet. It happens on social media. What is the thing that you are worried about, and what do you need to do to make sure it doesn't happen?
The dark side is very simple. The economic incentives in the economy are to exert more and more behavior modification control over people. It makes everybody more and more vain, paranoid, irritable, xenophobic, stupid, fearful. And then we lose the ability to talk to each other. We lose the ability to perceive reality accurately. We lose the ability to be intelligent fundamentally. And then we die because humans have soft bodies and our intelligence is the only thing that keeps us going. Otherwise, we get eaten. So we get eaten and we're gone. And I'm viewing that as a very serious possibility now because, you know, we have, just to be clear, anything stupid you can see on the internet existed before the internet. There were always conspiracy theories. All of that has existed. It's a question of degree and emphasis. And it's a question of how much amplification of our stupid stuff we can survive, right? It's a little bit like the climate. You know, like, can we survive 1% increased stupidity? I don't know, 1.5%. And it is actually like that. Some of the studies of the social contagion of paranoid and other negative reactions online, these things show like a small ambient rise. But the thing is, it appears to be cumulative and like compound interest, and it's so universal and so broad.
How does the metaverse get regulated then? Is there any role of government here?
Well, you know, I mean, I think in most human affairs, you end up with a combination of some regulation, mostly for extremes, some management of incentives, and some kind of a culture of guidance for decency, et cetera, et cetera. There's a multidimensional way that people make society and civilization work, you know, and be sustainable. I think that, though, that you have to get the incentives at least slightly aligned with human survival in order for society to be not nuts, you know?
Yeah. So should there be a global metaverse authority, GMA? I could head it.
I don't think in some hypothetical, very distant future, possibly, but I don't think we're ready for that or have any way to make something like that be okay. I kind of like some qualities of the American experiment. And one of them I really like is this idea of checks and balances, of having multiple institutions, each of which keep each other in check. And formally, we think of that as being like, you know, the judiciary and the executive and Congress. But also informally, we could say that capitalism and government keep each other in check, that they're two different systems that interface awkwardly, and yet they kind of have a way, hopefully, of reducing the excesses of either. And I think there are other systems like that, too. You know, one of the things, there's been this popular idea of intersectionality lately. I like the idea of people's identities also having a sort of a multitude of touch points so that it's hard for society to break on a clean line as the algorithms have made it do.
So one of the important things, of course, as you noted, you work for Microsoft, but you've also been a critic of tech companies and how they behave. And do you think it's important to be able to do that? Look at Frances Haugen left Facebook. Do you think it's important in these companies to allow this kind of public discourse about these things? Would it be healthier?
Yeah, I think it is healthy. And I feel like the tech companies are very big, very powerful. And I think having a little bit of speech inside them is a good thing, a necessary thing. And it's starting to happen a little bit more. And I think it's a shame that people feel they have to leave to do it. I'm hoping that that'll happen less and less often now.
Yeah. So I have a last question. You told GQ in a 2020 interview that your overarching project is to, quote, not fuck the future over. One, what did you mean by that? And two, have we fucked over our future?
Well, what I mean by that is there's a tendency in tech circles to immediately move to this idea that we're smarter than anybody who will ever live in the future. And naturally, we're smarter than anybody who's alive now. And so we're going to design the solution. We're just going to fix this climate thing. We're going to fix this racism thing. We're going to fix this behavior mod craziness thing. We're just going to fix it all. And we're just going to, we're going to be these like engineers for the future. And that'll be that. And I think that that in itself is a doomed approach. Because then those people in the future will be the recipients of this thing. Well, here's the solution we created for you. And they probably won't like it for one reason or another, if only for pride. What I'm trying to argue against is this idea of self-certainty and engineering the future. I think certain things that are very clearly defined and very concretely defined, like carbon emissions reduction targets or something like that, that's great. That's necessary, obviously. But some broader thing, I think what we need to do is remove the worst incentives, try to make the future easier for the people in the future to work with, and trust them. I am of the belief that if the manipulation model that drives the meta companies was just not present, that people would still be jerkier to a degree online than in real life, but to a minor degree. And we wouldn't see the global dysfunction and the falling apart of democracies everywhere at once.
Right. Or, Jaron, last thing, is this could all be a simulation, a metaverse simulation of a future Mark Zuckerberg, for example, version of him. And this is all just a game. A bunch of teenagers are playing with us and we're not really here.
Yeah. I know that's been an idea that's come about quite a lot. And, you know, the thing is, I could ask you what would be different. And if the answer is that nothing would be different, then it isn't even a question. The only thing that could really be different is that if this were a simulation, there'd be some possibility of stepping outside it and either being God or meeting God or something like that. So once again, a medieval sense of religiosity. And I think people trying to be God always ends badly.
Neither are we gods.
Nor should we wish to be.
Nor should we wish to be. Sway is a production of New York Times Opinion. It's produced by Naima Raza, Blakeney Schick, Matt Kwong, Daphne Chen, Caitlin O'Keefe, Elisa Gutierrez, and Wyatt Orm. Edited by Naima Raza, Blakeney Schick, and Allison Bruzek. With original music by Isaac Jones, mixing by Sonia Herrero and Carol Savaro, and fact-checking by Kate Sinclair, Michelle Harris, and Kristen Lin. Special thanks to Shannon Busta and Mahima Chabani. If you're in a podcast app already, you know how to get your podcast, so follow this one. If you're listening on the Times website and want to get each new episode of Sway delivered to you, along with a bunch of fucked up pigeons in a box, download any podcast app, then search for Sway and follow the show. We release every Monday and Thursday. Thanks for listening.